We need a trauma-informed society, you know. And we need a trauma-informed and an eco-informed society, you know. And if we don't go down that road, our arrogant species is finished.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
So our next guest is another where on first glance it might seem as if we have deviated from our stated aims of exploring barriers to and opportunities for well-being and growth within harsh institutions. However, we're hoping that looking at these issues from another tangentially related angle might shed some light into our more traditional areas of exploration. Our guest today, Simon Partridge, describes himself as a disillusioned ex-analyst and a freelance writer-researcher. He has covered community broadcasting, devolved politics, the British-Irish conflict, ethno-cultural mingling across the islands of Britain and Ireland, the psychobiological consequences of detached upper-class child-rearing and boarding residential schools, intergenerational war trauma and developmental trauma, complex PTSD. He posts on Boarding School Survivors Facebook and is a founding member of the London Adverse Childhood Experiences Hub, which we'll post a link to in our show notes. He continues to explore and write from lived experience about the linkage between early attachment deficits and ACEs. Welcome along today, Simon. Thanks for joining us.
Pleased to be here.
Hello, Simon. I'm very pleased to meet you. That's quite some introduction that Naomi has given you there. I'm very impressed. So, Simon, you've been pretty active in speaking up about trauma in the upper classes. Can you tell us something about your journey to this and why you're interested in it?
Well, David, I think it comes back to trying to sort out what made me and unmade me or didn't make me in the first place. I think my kind of serious investigation started after my last analysis ended, or I brought it to an end, in about 2004, when I kind of realized there was a sort of pattern that my analyses seemed to last about 7 years, which was the age I went off to boarding school. Actually, I went slightly younger to Whitby boarding school, but I was still six. And then I came across the work of Joy Chavarin, who was already starting to write, a Jungian psychotherapist, starting to write about the effects of boarding school. I started to make some links, and I think at the same time I was also exploring work by John Bowlby, and also Sue Gerhardt was very important at that point. She wrote a lovely little book, which you may be familiar with, Why Love Matters, which tied together to me for the first time really some of the psychoneurobiology and the trauma. So that's really where it started.
Thank you. Can you just tell us something about the sort of quality of the experience that you had in mind in reflecting upon this?
Well, I suppose it was, in a sense, despite, you know, the kind of rather seamless autobiography which Naomi read out, it wasn't quite like that in real life, you know. I was a sort of itinerant writer who found it very difficult to hold myself together in lots of ways. I mean, I think I probably resorted to writing because it was something that I could manage sort of intermittently, you know, and outside a very formal structure, which I don't function well in. I've always had a number of sort of, that lovely phrase, medically unexplained symptoms, you know. So I've kind of felt sort of rather dissociated, estranged from my body, uncomfortable, unable to find a place of safety. I think I've been sort of driven in a way to try and unpack that and sort out what the causes were. It might be summed up as a sort of state of rather general discomfort and problems in relationships. So it's, you know, I suppose I've been trying to explore what lies behind that, to try and make some sense of it and maybe try and be a bit more coherent.
Thank you. I think that's a very colourful description, really. So you've been involved in the group Boarding School Action, but you seem to be much more interested in what happens before a child gets sent to boarding school. So are you saying really that those experiences get compounded by being at boarding school?
Well, I'm not only involved in Boarding School Action, I'm involved in another Facebook group called Boarding School Survivors. So actually I probably spend a lot more time there than I do at Boarding School Action. I think what I've realised is, although I found the work of Joyce Chavarin and Nick Duffel very helpful, and I went on one of Nick's double weekend workshops in 2006, which is when I think I started to unpack quite seriously what the boarding school dimension of my problem might be. Going back beyond that really has taken me quite a long time. It's a sort of retrospective journey, if you like. I wouldn't say it's that I'm more interested in it, but what I have realised is that it's, I think, if you just talk about boarding school syndrome, for quite a lot of people it doesn't capture the full dimension of what's going on. And I had a lot of, this is where the disillusioned ex-analysand comes in, if you like. I had a lot of orthodox psychoanalysis, which certainly didn't get down to my early trauma. I did end up finally with a much more integrative psychotherapist who was into body stuff. And by then, I had a much clearer idea of what I wanted. You know, it's very difficult when you first go to a therapist, I think, because you're in a state of ignorance. The therapist is the authority figure, whether you like it or not. It probably took me 10 years to get to a point where I could say, I want this from a therapist, you know. Mm. So I wasn't going to be fobbed off anymore by an orthodox analyst who was only into transference. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it took me back to much earlier stuff. And, you know, it's absolutely awful if you're sent to boarding school at 6 or 7. But we all know that much happens in the developmental process before you get to 6 and 7, you know. And as I started to unpack that, help from this my last therapist, I realized there were some very early experiences which had impacted me hugely.
I'm sorry, I'm interested in knowing more about that, because I've never been to boarding school. I was, I think, very fortunate in that I went to a grammar school in Watford, which I always thought was a bit like a boarding school, but without the boarding part of it. You know, it had fantastic...
Some of them were modelled on boarding schools, indeed, no doubt.
Had fantastic facilities, physics labs, chemistry labs, massive, yeah, massive playing fields and a swimming pool, blah, 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 blah. So I thought I benefited a lot from that, but there was obviously some element that was different from what you're thinking of as a boarding school. What do you think that is?
Well, you were, I would suggest one of the basic differences, you went home to your family at the end of the school day, didn't you?
Yeah, of course.
Well, that is an enormous difference. I've just written a little article for the Private Education Policy Forum, pointing out to them that they've been lumping together all private education if it's one phenomenon. And I've had a very pleasant reception from the editor, who said, "We've never published anything like this before." I mean, to me, it's quite extraordinary, because the psychosocial dynamics of a day school are completely different from a boarding school, particularly if you go, you know, at a very early age. So, I mean, I would say, David, that is, you know, just no doubt there are other differences, but I think that is a kind of very stark difference which one can identify immediately.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think of how frightening and overwhelming it is for kids just to start day school, actually, and to be away from their mums and dads for, you know, for 6 hours, the thought of, you know, I can't even imagine actually how overwhelming and scary that could be for a young child to be sent away and know you're not going to see your parents, not just for 6 hours, but for days, weeks on end. You know, yeah, really quite overwhelming to even put yourself in that place, really.
Well, I think, as you were saying that name, you know, the word devastating came into my head. And I think, you know, yours is a kind of very humane reaction. And I think a lot of women and mothers would be their first reaction. How on earth can you send your kids away at that age?
Yeah.
But you see, if you look into the culture of the aristocracy and the upper class, it's the norm. And you were probably handed over to a nanny very early on. I mean, that was the other thing I came across. But I think, you know, my mother just didn't have the parenting skills to motherly skills. Why should she if she'd been brought up in a rather similar circumstance? Mm-hmm. So one is sort of farmed out almost immediately. And that's, I think, where there's enormous hidden damage the aristocracy and the upper class, the ruling classes, mm-hmm. which is easily normalised under this you know, slightly jokey phrase, the stiff upper lip.
Yeah.
Behind the stiff upper lip, there's a emotional disaster.
Yeah, and I was quite shocked when we had a previous guest on who spoke about wet nursing still being used, which, you know, I mean, when I learned history at school, we were taught about that being something that happened in, you know, much, you know, centuries ago. I was quite shocked to hear that was still happening. And of course, actually, that's one of the ways it's promoted for, you know, bonding with your children. So the breastfeeding promotion is not just about the breast milk is good for the child, but also that whole process, you know, and the promotion of for men also to have skin to skin contact with their child. So just thinking that even from the very early days, it sounds like amongst some sections of society, there would be that removal of that basic need that's there for children to have that really close physical contact with their parents.
Well, you've summed it up rather well. I suppose the other thing I might put in there is the sort of whole issue of the hormone oxytocin, the sort of love bond. And in actual fact, yes, wet nursing was certainly going on in the early part of the 20th century. Churchill had a wet nurse, for instance. Mm-hmm. Prophecy Coles has written a very interesting book about the role of mothers and surrogate mothers called The Shadow of the Second Mother. And she unpacks the dynamics of wet nursing in a very sensitive way, and points out that not only, well, it can have a devastating effect on the wet nurse child, also the children of the wet nurses. When you start to think about it, these are usually poor women from a rural background, and it was, you know, one of the few ways they could earn money. Here's another interesting fact which not many people know about. Freud's daughter had a wet nurse, and there's some implication that Freud himself had a wet nurse. Melanie Klein certainly had a wet nurse, and has to make a connection between her intense interest in breasts and the fact she had a wet nurse.
Yeah.
It's not mentioned in the analytic literature at all. I had to do some sort of fairly original research, partly with the help of Prophecy Coles, to get the some handle on this. I mean, it's just totally ignored. Sorry, I'm getting a bit emotional. Maybe you can understand why.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, absolutely. And so it sounds, you know, like for children from the upper class being sent away to boarding school, you know, there's damage and disadvantage to that. To that kind of like arrangement of child rearing even before you're taken away from the family. A bit, I suppose, like when we think about children who get removed and are cared for via the local authority, and so there's an association of being in children's homes with being quite damaging, but most people are probably wise to the fact that children who are in care have already, you know, suffered neglect and possibly abuse to be in those circumstances, when people are not really mindful of that when it comes to children who go to boarding school.
I suppose it's really, this is where the issue of social background and class comes in, because yes, it's so normalised in the upper class that people don't ask those questions. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit extraordinary, really. Because if you could see the neglect in the upper class, people would say, why do we let this go on? Mm. It's much easier to project it onto poorer people who have evidently, you know, disadvantages in their lives. And for reasons beyond their control, can't really look after their children very well. But we're actually talking about a group of people who have plenty of financial resources, in actual fact don't know how to provide the emotional support children need. But there is a kind of added complication, I think, which very interesting attachment-oriented therapist Anne Power has pointed out. And she says, and I've come to agree with her, although initially she was quite critical of some of the stuff I wrote. She said, one of the things you do learn in an upper-class environment is this kind of learnt avoidance. You lived in this rather detached family background. Emotions are dampened down. There is a lack of physical contact, and, you know, which feeds into this phrase, the stiff upper lip. But in some ways, actually, prepares you quite well being sent away to school. You have the avoidant defences, which maybe people from a less upper-class background don't have. And one of the things I've come to see is that I think that, and this is something I picked up from the Boarding School Survivors Facebook page, is that the people who seem to have the most extreme reaction to boarding school weren't the people from an upper-class background. They were people who had been sent to boarding school for other reasons, that, you know, their parents were in the forces, mm-hmm. they were overseas. Occasionally it was somebody who was very aspirational, whose parents had made a lot of money quite quickly and wanted to send their kids to boarding school for the social advantages that does bring. So I think that it's quite complicated in that sense. I think one of the problems with a sort of narrow view of boarding school syndrome is it doesn't really explain how, in actual fact, so many people seem to go through the system without too much of a problem, overtly anyway. So this is what I've come to call the British upper class complex trauma condition, because mm-hmm. I think it does need to be named and recognised. It's much more difficult to see than somebody who's clearly in sort of emotional pain and overt dysfunction. I would say somebody like Boris Johnson clearly has dissociative symptoms, which I think anybody who knows a bit about psychology can spot. Mm-hmm. You know, his incapacity to engage face-to-face for more than about 10 seconds, he turns away, if you see him interviewed, mm-hmm. Not to mention the disorganisation of his own private life. But he functions in a way, and he functions with minimal criticism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the norms are kind of coming in a way. Now, why doesn't Andrew Marr actually say to him, look, Mr. Johnson, could you please look at me for more than 10 seconds? Mm-hmm. It would be impolite, wouldn't it, really?
Well, I think that's a really good observation, because I think a lot of the people that we encounter who perhaps have, you know, been in care, what have you, they've often come from families where they've had very limited means of coping with their overwhelming emotions. So perhaps used drink or drugs or criminal behaviour in order to, you know, violence in order to act out their emotions. Where, you know, just think about how we promote learning. I mean, I use learning myself as a way of coping, and intellectualisation is a good strategy, isn't it? And it keeps you in a part of the brain where you're much more in control in some ways. And I guess for, you know, families that go to, for kids that go to boarding school, that's really promoted. They're in an environment where that single coping resource is really heavily promoted. And I think, you know, we do see people in custody in the criminal justice system occasionally who've been to boarding school, but obviously they're few and far between, even though, you know, the amount of pain that the child has experienced is, it might well be very comparable, but they've had different coping resources promoted for them, most probably, so not ended up in committing crimes, or certainly not the typical crimes that bring people into prison.
Yes, I'm sure the reasons people end up in prison are kind of quite diverse. I mean, I'd be quite interested to know that people you come across from boarding school in prison, I would also like to know what their social background is. I mean, I suspect it may not be typical about the fact upper-class entrance to boarding school. I mean, that might be quite an interesting thing to pursue. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, you mentioned acting out, but we know also that the misuse of, or the use of drugs is a way of, you know, self-medication, mm-hmm. soothing pain. I think, you know, there's a lot of alcohol consumed within the sort of upper class. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's probably the drug of choice. And there's a lot of family dysfunction there as well. So yes, I think, and in a way, you know, to go back to sort of some of my own ruminations about my background, I mean, I think I'm also aware that in some ways I've been using my head to cope with some more basic emotional and body issues in lots of ways. So yes, there's and the other thing to point out is that, you know, boarding school is an incredibly structured environment. You are very rarely left to your own devices, and you know, one or two of my friends have been in that environment. Very aware about how they have to keep busy, because if they don't keep busy, then some of the more underlying issues, painful, disturbing, come to the fore. So it's a highly organised, structured environment in which, in actual fact, there's a lot of balance as well, mm-hmm. in lots of ways. So it's there is plenty of violence in that environment. It's contained partly previously within the very hierarchical structure of fagging and the senior pupils having an awful lot of power over junior ones. A bit of the Lord of the Flies situation, you know.
It's a sort of legitimised bullying, really, I suppose.
You got it, David.
So you've been describing a varied picture. You've been telling us really that boarding school syndrome covers, you know, a variety of presentations. We shouldn't assume that everyone is the same who's in this kind of situation. I think that's helpful to enhance our thinking about it. And you've
Can I just add a point there? Yeah. I think one of the kind of analogies I've been pursuing recently is between the idea of PTSD and complex PTSD. And in a way, you know, it took quite a long time for Judith Herman to differentiate more straightforward single incident trauma leading to PTSD to something much more chronic and ongoing, and not necessarily major traumas in their own right, the accumulation of trauma. And so, I mean, I'm kind of sort of, in a way, talking about, in some ways you could call it complex or boarding school syndrome, and a more less complex boarding school syndrome. That might be also quite a helpful distinction.
Well, I think like Gaba Maté talks a lot about it not so much being the trauma as the response to the trauma, doesn't he? And I think that perhaps becomes significant as well, because lots of people do have experiences of abuse or, you know, kind of like big traumas as opposed to those little smaller traumas that build on each other. But there's something about what you're met with that enables you to then cope with the trauma. So if you experience, for instance, sexual trauma outside the family home and you're able to talk about it with your parents and receive validation and support, then the chances are that's easier to recover from. Whereas if you're in an environment where actually those things can't be spoken of, you know, there is nobody there to offer the support and the comfort. I'm curious about how much comfort is available in boarding schools, you know, what is offered in place of a parent. I get that it's not going to be the same, but is anything offered? Is there any attempt to try and offer comfort to children?
Very good question, Annie. I mean, I think I have to recognise, you know, I went to boarding school in the late 1950s, early 1960s, and I don't think the word comfort was in circulation. And it couldn't, you know, in a sense, because the whole ethos of the institution is to toughen you up. You know, there's we're talking about sort of views of the world. I mean, I think if you use a word like comfort, you know, you're kind of talking about a sort of world which has been influenced by modern views of developmental psychology, of attachment, I guess, people like us who are familiar with the world of psychotherapeutics. You have to see the world of the boarding school traditionally as being completely counter to that. It had nothing to do with that, and historically, it goes back partly to aristocratic families who sent their children out from their own family to be turned into functioning knight warriors, you know. I mean, if we unpack this historically, it has a very long history, coupled with the idea of the church removing children from the family to indoctrinate them in the beliefs of Christianity. So I in a way, I think, you know, it's almost a different world. And just institutionally, it's very, very difficult to replace the intimacy and the knowledge of a family with an institution. I mean, you know, even in sort of good social care, it's incredibly difficult, even if you take a child out of a dysfunctional family, to find an institution which can really replicate what a good family would provide for a child. You know, it's almost a contradiction in terms, I think.
Absolutely. There was someone was posting recently an Ofsted report into a children's home up in the northwest, I think, and it was posted because it was amazing that this home was perceived as being such a fantastic example of how children's homes ought to be, that the house parents knew and loved the children, and that came across the individualised care plans. But, you know, I was quite shocked, actually, Simon, when, and I shouldn't be, I realise, but quite shocked when you said the whole point to boarding school was actually to toughen children up. So of course comfort wouldn't be figuring on the radar, but having seen adverts for boarding schools that are still taking children at primary school age, you can only hope that the ethos that drives them has changed for those poor kids that go there now.
Well, I wouldn't, you know, I think, as I say, I mean, I think in a way, you know, I'm a bit of a legacy. And I think Duffel himself has got stuck a bit in the past, since he keeps referring back to this film made in 1990, Making of Them, which is a very powerful film. one could say yes, but things have changed. And they have to some extent, Emmy, you know. I think the fact is, I mean, it goes back to this sort of question of whether an institution, yes, they're more comfortable, the food is better, you know, there's not ice on the windows in the winter, etc., etc. The fact is, you're removing a child from the familial environment at an age which is much too young. And more than a third of these kids now come from overseas.
Yeah.
It's a bit like in the old days, like something like Rudyard Kipling sent back from India, you know. So these people are being transported thousands of miles to a completely alien environment, probably a climate which is very different, possibly not likely not to be speaking their mother tongue, you know. What's going on with these children?
Yeah.
In a way, they're just customers, you know. And so I think that while you, if you look at the brochures which these places put out at the moment, they've taken up some of the language of childcare, you know. I really question that, natural fact, whether it gets to grips with the emotional. It can't, you know. I mean, I just don't think you can. Sometimes you have to remove children from families, you know. But don't kid me that, in actual fact, what you put in its place is very much like a warm, caring, intimate family environment. Mm-hmm. It can't.
Yeah, of course.
So, Simon, you've given us, I think, a very good description of intergenerational trauma and how it gets developed and perpetuated in the upper classes. Do you have any thoughts on how this kind of trauma affects other people in society, how it may be perpetuated in other groups in society?
So that's a very good question, David. It's a bit difficult for me to answer it. I mean, you might have a better answer than me. You know, I come from the upper class. Not, I mean, by no means as well implanted as other some other people I know. I mean, Alex Renton, who I know, who wrote Stiff Upper Lip. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
On his mother's side, he's the 12th generation boarder. Well, I can only go back to my half-French grandfather, you know, who went to Eton. So in some ways, my family's quite nouveau. I think this is something we really need to have a discussion about, because I carry my own social baggage, and I've been trying to find a way out. And I suppose in some ways, I'm quite amazed by the lack of pushback from people who don't come from my background. And one can see this again in the case of Boris Johnson. You know, how does he get away with it? It might be something the three of us could have a little discussion about. I'll give you one or two suggestions for what I think happened, but they may not be close to the mark. I think there's this thing of it's almost kind of I think one of your questions is something about class. Well, it's partly the accent, isn't it? It's partly the body posture. It's partly an assumption that you hold a position of power in society, and you know that's actually kind of it's a very powerful thing to have. Other people perhaps feel dependent on people like me for their job, for their place in society, for a certain kind of shame which is projected into them. I mean, do you remember Osborne's comment about the Sherpas? I mean, it was a disgraceful thing to say from somebody in his position. So he immediately I think it was in the early stages of austerity. And he was trying to divide not himself, but the rest of society into two groups, the hard workers and the shirkers.
Yes.
And it was a kind of classic divide and rule device, which people from my class have been using for centuries. You know, we know how to do it very well. But then, in actual fact, what you do is you then set a subclass against each other, you know. So you stand there as the kind of authority voice. And Osborne's got money coming out of his ears, and then lecture the rest of society, saying that, yes, you know, some people are kind of staying at home and not working. Those things about twitching curtains. I mean, he laid it on with a trowel, you know. And I just thought, you know, this is very clever manipulation. You can only do that sort of manipulation from a position of entitled security, you know. And the trouble, I think, I'll stop in a moment because I could go on. But I mean, I think one of the other problems is that the commentators in our society quite often come from a similar or aspiringly similar background. So they never quite tie these people down. So Johnson actually is never pushed to state how many children he's got. He always gets away with it. I think he can only get away with it because there's a certain deference which is so built in to aspects of the British psyche that nobody dares to, you know, say the Emperor's naked.
Well, I think you're right.
I mean, I don't know how you see. I'm really interested in how you experience it.
I think it's been going on for a long time, hasn't it? I was reading about the capture and the ransom of Richard the Lionheart the other day, and of course his ransom represented about 25% of the GNP at the time, which took us as a British people a long time to pay off.
Well, it's like the money paid to the slavers, you know.
Indeed.
Yeah. But I read Inglorious Empire recently about obviously the British in India, and it was interesting that you talk about that.
Partly my background.
Yeah, well, it was interesting that you talked about the divide and rule, because that was a striking thing that I took from the book, actually, was how much those same strategies had been used in Britain within the class system as are used overseas. There's very much that way of dividing the lower classes so they're too busy criticising each other rather than critiquing the people who've got this power over them. And I suppose, you know, you spoke also about people, there being a difference between people who go to private schools generally as well from those that go to boarding schools. And I guess if you go to a private school generally, you go home and the chances are there are kids on your street who don't or who live nearby. You might go to clubs, you know, sports clubs, where you're interacting with kids that don't have that same privileged education, whereas if you're at boarding school, the chances are everyone that you interact with is in that environment. And you know, the messages within those environments, you know, the kind of posters that are up that tell people that they are amongst the elite, that their place in society when they finish school is going to be in the top level, they'll be mixing with politicians and what have you. It's quite hard for those messages not to drip feed in and sink in a way that other people might get messages about their low self-esteem. You know,
I think you've put your finger on something there. It's very self-perpetuating, which is why, at least, I think it's a sign of the times that the Private Education Policy Forum has sort of finally thought, yeah, maybe we should stop lumping them together. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what, you know, take quite seriously. So it's a very insidious process. And I think this is jumping slightly, but I think because of the Black Lives Matter stuff, because Alex Renton's latest book, actually, and I know Alex a bit, is called Blood Legacy, mm-hmm. which is about his family's involvement with the slave mm-hmm. trade in the West Indies. My French family went east to Bengal, which is a somewhat different situation. Has some parallels, mm-hmm. and he pointed me towards a very interesting Jamaican psychiatrist healer who I'd never heard of till a couple of weeks ago, called Dr. Frederick Hickling, I can certainly give you some links to him.
That would be good.
And he's actually come up with this. I mean, he's a brilliant man. Sadly died last year. But he has sort of completely deconstructed the effect of colonialism in the West Indies. And he talked about white European psychosis. And I think he's meaning that as a kind of social psychopathology, which is terribly difficult to recognize and name. This is in actual fact what drives the appalling excesses of slavery. But, you know, we have our own sort of internal colonies, and people at the top of society, metaphorically anyway, get away with murder. You know, we have our own, and Hickling talks about owning our own madness.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a very difficult area to unpack, and I think we're only starting to do it. I mean, I think we're putting our fingers on some very insidious and destructive elements in our own society and culture, which we actually have to now finally confront and unpack. And you all know, I mean, I'm sure you're well aware, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, that so many people who end up in prison end up there through no fault of their own, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's socially determined, you know. Yeah. They didn't stand a chance. And once you're down at the bottom of the pile, chances of getting up again are really quite small.
Well, absolutely. And I was just thinking, actually, the difference in terms of how we, you know, for instance, the financial crisis being caused by reckless behaviour of bankers, thinking about all the corruption around the PPE contracts, where people have, you know, been awarded millions in contracts because of who they know, you know, dodgy deals, and how differently that's treated from the person who shoplifts, you know, the baby food from their supermarket, because they actually can't afford to feed their child. You know, gross discrepancy in terms of what's seen as being legitimate and what isn't.
But let's put a kind of name on that. I mean, I think is where Fred Hickling's word psychosis is, I think, useful, at least to point out the marker. There's something mad about that name.
Yes.
You know, there's something mad in a culture which, in actual fact, can't make those links, you know, which lets them go by. I mean, there's a kind of total dissociation at one point. Because, you know, I think most of us would admit it's wrong. You know, if we could stop and think, even people at the top would say, yeah, that's not right.
Mm.
But somehow there's something in our culture which prevents us from actually calling it out.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings me nicely onto our next question, actually, because I wondered if trauma being perpetrated by upper class people might be harder to address. You know, is it legitimised because it's embedded in the structures of the establishment, so disguised in some way?
Well, it's almost unaddressable. Yes, of course, it's hidden. I mean, it's sort of almost a definitional problem, because I think that, and this is where it gets complicated, because who actually defines trauma?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a way, it's the medical profession to some extent and the psychotherapeutic profession, which for a long time, and this is where the innovation of Joy Chavron and Nick Buffer was, at least to say, look, boarding schools are creating a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I started going to see an analyst, you know, back in, I don't know, the 1980s, there was no notion that it's my the source of my problems, you know. So it's, I mean, in a way, one has to come, for me anyway, it comes back to some sort of norm of care. And specifically early child infant care. And I mean, I think it was Bowlby's genius, for me anyway, picked up by Sue Gerhardt and mm-hmm. by Judith Herman, although she's American, so I think her background's a bit different. But, you know, Bowlby saw that without that very early care, all sorts of things go wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to dissociate from the pain. We act out or we self-soothe. But I think it provides a different sort of norm, which is quite difficult in our society, because we are actually saying, look, if you don't give kids their right sort of nurture at the beginning, all sorts of things are going to go wrong. So it's a kind of baseline. I think as a culture, we find it very difficult to identify baselines. And in actual fact, if you judge the sort of mores and the kind of traditions of the upper class against that baseline, they fail at almost every turn. You know, mm-hmm. Not only is the pedagogy wrong, the traditions within the family are wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, it scores appallingly. You know, but somehow because they're at the top, because they in actual fact set norms, because they dictate, because you know, they can say who is a shirk and who isn't. It's incredibly difficult to call it out. And I have to confess, I think the psychotherapy professions have been slow on this as well, you know. Mm-hmm. I think we're all complicit in some ways.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking, Simon, as you were talking, about poverty and how little that's spoken of, actually, as a trauma. And yet how frequently that's spoken of with certainly people I've worked with in prison about the poverty, absolute poverty within their families, and how stigmatising and shaming that poverty was, that meant that, you know, they didn't have enough school uniform, so they often smelled, or, you know, they couldn't wash their school uniform frequently enough because they had no washing machine and there wasn't enough of it to have a change of clothing. And
hardly their fault, is it?
Well, exactly. And yet that poverty is inflicted, but so, you know, I suppose what comes to mind is Jacob Rees-Mogg celebrating the fact that we've got so many food banks in this country. You know, that's a poverty that is inflicted on millions of people in this country. It's heartbreaking to think about how many kids are growing up without having regular, you know, enough food to eat. And yet people are very quick to make judgments about people who use interpersonal violence, and obviously that's not okay either, but actually there are millions more people affected by poverty than will be affected by violent crime. You know, it just seems to go unaccounted for.
And what you're just saying has sort of brought me back to adverse childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. Because I think that possibly one of the weaknesses, certainly in the American form of the adverse childhood experience, is questions. Is it didn't focus enough on poverty? Mm-hmm. I would say yes, poverty is a big ace, really mm-hmm. big ace, and it's also one of the dangers in a sort of rather blanket term, white privilege. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of white people, if we're going to use that sort of binary, not privileged. So yes, I mean, I'm, and it also circles back a bit to my involvement with the London ACES Hub, and the fact that I was the first person to discover that the term adverse childhood experiences wasn't coined by Dr. Felitti in 1998. It was actually coined by John Bowlby mm-hmm. in 1981. And I want to make that link rather firmly, or very firmly, to the detachment tradition. Because Bowlby understood that, mm-hmm. maybe not in the first dimensions, because the neurobiology was much less developed in those days. Bowlby knew that if you didn't have that right early nurture, not only did it do you damage, but it in actual fact laid you open to further damage down the line. It was a kind of two-stage process. And I think we can see that, Naomi, being enacted all the time, you know, and I suspect people, encounter in the criminal justice system mostly have an high ACE score. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know the statistics, but we know an awful lot of people in the criminal justice system have mental health.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's But again, you know, it becomes very compounded, because if you're not functioning well mentally, you're not going to be able to earn a decent living. You know, it becomes a very vicious circle. And in some ways, I thank my lucky stars that I came from a background where there was still enough money left over from the Indian enterprise to prevent me falling into the gutter. You know, and sometimes I hate to think what would have happened to me if I'd come from a, if I'd been as mixed up as I was and I'd come from a really poor background.
Yeah, quite a startling thought. And I suppose earlier you spoke about it. You know, it took you 10 years of therapy to realise even what you wanted going forward. And I suppose, for people who don't have many financial resources, therapy is expensive. There's big waiting lists on the NHS, and what you can get on the NHS is often quite short term. But also that sense of, if it takes a long time to realise actually what you want to change and be different, you know, how disadvantaged people in the criminal justice system or from other groups of society where they don't have many financial resources, how disadvantaged they are in terms of getting what they need from therapy also. You know, you have the chance to figure that out, but other people wouldn't have that luxury necessarily. I also wondered, Simon, whether, you know, class is obviously something that you've spent a lot of time thinking about. And I wondered if you always been conscious of your class and class difference, or is that something you came to later in life?
Good question. I don't think one is, you know, I think this is my view now, that social background is a bit like water we're born into, you know. I mean, I don't think any of us are probably that aware of it initially. It's just the environment in which you were brought up, you know. And, I mean, in some ways I'm upper class, but in other ways I come from a rather peculiar background. As I said, there's a sort of French connection, which then got mixed up with the Raj. My great grandfather who was French ended up in Worthing because he married an English governess. And then, in actual fact, my father, who was sort of his father was self-made. They were tenant farmers. He didn't know anything about this, but I did find it out after he died. He bought a small. He went to a public school, Eastbourne College. He sent me there. He was actually very successfully acculturated there. Ended up, went off to become a Royal Marine at the age of 17 at the Royal Naval College of Greenwich. Ended up in the Fleet Air Arm. And I'm sure he thought at one point he thought it was just sort of a rather romantic adventure. And then got caught up in the Second World War. Had some horrific experiences there. And was a prisoner of war for 5 years. I carry some of that somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have these kind of family idiosyncrasies. Then he bought a small farm. He never once made the connection between buying that farm and the history of his own family. One of the things I've discovered and regret in a way is that one of the problems with this kind of boarding education is it cuts you off from your own family history, your own family capital. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've come to see my mother as somebody who was completely lost, really. She didn't know where she came from. She had no connections with her own French background. She sort of floated around and had enough money really not to engage with the world very much. So I was brought up the first sort of 13 years or 10 years that anyway, conscious years, on a small farm in the East Sussex countryside. So I don't think in that circumstance I was very much aware of my my social background. And then I was sent off to this primary boarding school, you know, which was also in the countryside. But it seemed to be the sort of thing that was done, you know. So I think I suppose I became more aware in my late teens because this was the 1960s, which was also a period of transition. You know, I now have a rather longer history than I care to recall. But, I suppose that's when I became actually slightly embarrassed about my background, because in some ways it was a sort of rather vibrant working class culture which entered popular culture, the Beatles, you know. Mm-hmm. I think I probably disguised my accent somewhat. It certainly wasn't something that one flaunted very much. And the irony is, in some ways, it's come full circle, because if you get to the 1990s, you know, in some ways, then new money and the sort of Thatcher-Reagan counter-revolution, the neoliberalism, was in full flood. So I think in some ways... we've gone full circle, and maybe now we're starting to come out the other side again, which is interesting, I think, and maybe one reason why we're asking some of these questions in a more pointed way. No, I haven't always been aware of class, and I think I would say it's only in the last year or two I've managed to, in actual fact, really, I think, integrate more fully the psychological side of myself with the more sort of social class side, and see how they have interacted with each other. I think I'm not sure we actually have the vocabulary yet to because psychology and psychotherapy tends to be very individually based. Mm-hmm. Yet in some ways we now are more aware that so much of our own identities is socially constructed. Mm-hmm. Which is why I'm not entirely happy with this term, white psychosis, you know, because I think it even the notion of psychosis seems to have a very individual kind of resonance. It's more like some social psychopathology where certainly high class is caught up in, but then I think lower classes are subjected to it. Mm-hmm. But in a way, we've all been affected by the sort of the modern world. Mm-hmm. I don't think any of us can escape from it, which is where I think Frederick Hickling is right. In some ways, we all have to own our own madness. It's not exactly equivalent, but I think I think this conversation is part of that. Is to open up a space, and I like to borrow Winnicott's notion of the transitional space, in which we bring these very difficult, problematic ideas, and actually learn to be more honest with each other. And I think, you know, if you come from an oppressive class, you have to earn the oppression. But if you're one of the oppressed, you also have to say, yeah, look, it affected me and didn't do me any good in lots of ways. But, you know, I think this is a conversation which is only just beginning, Naomi. I mean, I think it's a very important one, but not an easy one and very complicated. So I would say, really, look, I'm still exploring this.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I think throughout this conversation it's seemed like there are lots of commonalities, actually, at the two extremes of society. You know, they're kind of the more affluent and the ones with less affluence. So that kind of like embarrassment of the accents, I thought was quite interesting to hear you say, having been in situations where I've gone to pubs down south and heard people mocking my northern accents in a quite disparaging way. So it's interesting to hear you'd had a similar experience. So just a really tiny question for you, Simon. How do we start to change things? Have you got any thoughts on this? And how do we do that without people feeling guilty and ashamed and becoming defensive? How do we have these conversations in a broader way?
Well, I was quite interested in your word disparagement. I mean, can we learn to talk without disparaging each other?
Mm.
I think that's the challenge, in a way. And I think what we've been engaged in is a sort of mini example of it. Mm-hmm. You know, we've you know, you've invited me into a space. You know, I've been invited to unpack some quite difficult things. You've popped one or two quite difficult questions in my direction, but in a kind of not unfriendly way. You know, not a disparaging way. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things I found so disappointing about the whole Brexit debate was lack of debate. You know, how crude it was, how it became so binary. You know, there was no place to do an up with that, explore very, very difficult, important questions. And to some extent, you know, the sort of modern media are helping, but and the irony is it's been so difficult, hasn't it, over the last 18 months or so with COVID, for people actually to meet face-to-face, and this is a sort of substitute in some ways. But, I mean, I like this whole idea of citizens' assemblies, you know. I mean, I think we have to create spaces where some of these really difficult, painful issues in society, you know, why in a rich society like ours do we tolerate food banks?
Yeah.
You know? Why are rich families allowed to send their kids away at the age of 7? That's child abuse. You know, the fact that they're rich kids is not here, neither here nor there. You know, what's going on? So my response really is to I think we have to create more of these forums, you know, and I think you've got a little prototype here.
Well, I think you're hitting on something. I think with the way that we as a society manage to have discussions, I'm just thinking about two really offensive terms that have cropped up. So in relation to Brexit, you hear the word gammon being used to disparage people who voted for, you know, a certain kind of person who might have voted for Brexit. And then I suppose when you're talking about race, you also hear the term Karen being used as a way of disparaging. And all that does is push people further apart, doesn't it? And then you see the amazing work that's been done with, there was that an Asian filmmaker who went and interviewed members of the Ku Klux Klan, and incredible work being done by treating people with respect, even when, you know, they might not seem to be inviting that. But actually what does become possible when you're willing to have some respect and curiosity about the other person's position. So I wondered, Sam, whether you wanted to say something about the London ACES Hub, actually, given we're talking about how we create change.
I just wanted to throw one more word into your list there. That's the word woke, you know, which is being used as a kind of insult.
Yes, yes.
Yes, I mean, I think when I got into ACES before I discovered the connection to Bowlby, by the way, which is quite interesting. I discovered that by accident. Was very pleased. Because I certainly have been motivated very strongly by the whole attachment, relation, movement. I think when I got to 70, I kind of thought, you know, unwelcome realization that the road doesn't go on forever, you know. I had this idea partly inspired by what went on in Scotland. I mean, I don't know whether you're familiar with the ACES movement in Scotland or. But a woman who I've got to know quite well, Suzanne Zeedine, organised or helped organise this fantastic conference in Glasgow in September 2018. And about the same time, the film Resilience started to circulate, premiered in London. Are you familiar with Resilience?
Yes, yes. But perhaps you'd like to say something more about that?
Well, It was made by Robert Redford's son, Jamie Redford, who sadly is also deceased, died of cancer last year. But it was a brilliant popularization. It's an educational documentary, really. But it took the ACE idea off the psychotherapy books and off Dr. Felitti and Anders research. I mean, are you familiar with the ACE study?
Yes. But again, if you want to say something about that, because we might have listeners.
Yeah, well,
I
mean, it's an academic epidemiological study of a sample of more than 17,000 patients from Felitti's health maintenance organisation, Kaiser Permanente. But it was the first. I got to know it in its in fact. I reviewed a book with it in 2012 and didn't realise how important it was. It's a very thoroughly argued piece of work, and it kind of more or less, I think, sort of puts beyond reasonable doubt the connection between trauma and ill health, mm-hmm. not just mental ill health, but physical ill health. You know, it's very difficult to brush aside a study which has such an evidence base, and I think most people accept it. You know, and it's a bit of a light bulb moment if you haven't sort of thought that way before. It's a paradigm shifter. For people like us, David and Naomi, who live in our heads a bit, but most people don't. But when a film comes along made by Robert Redford's son, who was a brilliant independent filmmaker, and was speaking obviously from his own experience mm-hmm. of difficulty, it was, you know, it appeared at the right time, and then it was followed up by this conference in Glasgow, which was fantastic successful. And in actual fact, Suzanne's written a very good piece about how it happened. And I suddenly thought, well, and then I met somebody else who'd been to the conference and who happened to live in London, like this guy. And I thought, well, you know, as a kind of bit of a firework display before I kind of disappear into the background, wouldn't it be nice to organise a similar conference in London? And because of my work on devolution and stuff going back, I mean, I'm quite convinced we have to have a more decentralised political system. You know, it can't all happen in Westminster. So I was quite clear it was going to be London-based, it was going to basically talk to London, which has its own sort of rather feeble assembly, but it does have it. The idea, from my point of view, was a big sort of firework display. You know, we'd hold a big conference, lots of sparks would fly out, it'd land, and goodness knows what would happen. As a swan song, it seemed quite an attractive idea. And of course, we got ambushed by COVID.
Yeah, yeah.
But it, you know, the idea has survived, and in actual fact, I think we've created a very good website, and some initiatives are getting going, but it's been hampered by COVID, like everything else. It's the strap line, which wasn't invented by me, by Journey, who was the four conspirators really. Initially, and she says, spreading the seeds and joining the dots, which in a way I think is what we're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's trying to provide a space where some of the good practice can be elaborated and passed on, and you know, in some ways the strap line is trauma informed. You know, mm-hmm. we the ambition is to make London a trauma informed city.
Mm-hmm.
Let's aim high. We need a trauma-informed society, you know, and we need a trauma-informed and an eco-informed society, you know. And if we don't go down that road, you know, our arrogant species is finished. Mm. You know, it's curtains. I mean, you know, the writing's on the wall. So, I mean, I think these things are sort of starting to come together. But, you know, there's the pushback from those who want to keep their heads in the sand, hold on to their positions of power and the old ways of doing things. So it's an interesting moment to be in. I wish I was 10 years younger in some ways, you know.
But it sounds like a good...
A link to the hard work, right?
Yeah, well, it sounds like a good initiative to have got going. But, David, I wasn't sure of whether you wanted to say something. I'm conscious I feel like I've been hogging the interview. Sorry.
Yeah, that's fine. I was just wondering, Simon, whether you've come across the Enabling Town Slough movement. I was just picking up on your description just then. Have you heard of that?
Vaguely, yes. But it's a long way down my horizon, David. You know, I can't pretend to any great familiarity.
No, that's not a problem. I'll send you a link. But that's also a place where they've been trying very hard to do the kind of things that you've just been talking about, really, to create new places for people to get together and to support each other and talk things through.
Yeah, it's quite a...
Carry on.
I was just going to say, I think there's quite a few cities in America as well, aren't there, where they've been trying to really make themselves trauma-informed cities. So it just seemed to be a bit of a moment for people trying to harness some kind of collective energy, which obviously is going to be more powerful than one or two people plodding along.
Well, I mean, the ACEs movement in the States is it's almost mainstream now. Which has its advantages and disadvantages, you know, because it'll get caught up in the systems of power if it's not careful. But Nadine Burke-Harris, who came to Glasgow, spoke at Glasgow, went back to California and somehow got the governor to create a position for herself. She's now called the Surgeon General of California and is running this statewide ACE program, which has the goal of reducing ACEs by half within a generation. You know, when the Americans get an idea, they pick it up and they run with it. So, you know, I mean, there's lots of stuff going on there which makes what we're doing here look rather pedestrian. Mm-hmm. But it's in an American context and it has its advantages and disadvantages. But, it's happening all over the States now. You know, they talk about the ACE collaboration. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty mainstream and, you know, people like Winfrey Opry are promoting it. I was trying to think the other day, who in the British media would promote ACEs like Winfrey Opry? I couldn't sort of find the equivalent. Mm-hmm. But okay, every bit we do, these little conversations we're having, it's actually all adding to something. And I think you're right, David. There are these kind of initiatives opening up, and it rather depends which side of the bed I get out of in the morning, whether I feel incredibly depressed or quite elated.
Well, that's quite interesting that you should say that, because we've just come to our final question, Simon, which is, you know, generally one that we ask of most people, that, you know, you've been very immersed in a subject area that shaped your life, and how do you keep yourself positive about the possibility of change? So is it through, you know, involvement in things like the London ACES Hub and the boarding school survivors? Is it that sense of activism that gives you a sense of being able to keep going, or are there other things that you draw on to nourish and enrich yourself?
I enjoy my garden. Mm-hmm. I've never completely left mm-hmm. the countryside of my childhood, mm-hmm. Which is quite an interesting link back into things ecological, actually. Mm-hmm. So I get an enormous amount of how can I put it? Sort of sustenance from nature and the complexities of nature. And I've been very intrigued by robin in my garden recently, who I got two or three really friendly robins. Aren't robins fantastic? I mean, they have this sort of, you know, there is actually a kind of robin primate species relationship. They know how to use us. We like it a lot. There's been a robin in my garden pecking at the grass. I'm thinking, what's he doing there? In actual fact, there are quite a lot of ants in the grass I've discovered, and he's going there and he's kind of getting an ant breakfast. Maybe not very good news for ants, but it's. And I've always been impressed by the absolute, you know, beautiful complexity of nature. I mean, David Attenborough, I think, catches it very well. And really, I think, you know, our species needs to. Maybe I just end on this note because it was a thought that came to my mind. I mean, I think we've, and it gets back to a comment we were making a bit earlier on about using our minds too much. And, you know, the intelligence we deploy is nothing compared to the ecological intelligence that's all around us in nature. I mean, we live in the most incredibly complex of systems. And we're really rather crude, and we'd better stop bumping around, you know.
Mm-hmm. That seems a perfect note to finish. Simon, thank you very much. That's been a really thought-provoking conversation. I'm really grateful to you for coming on today.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and one never quite knows what's going to happen. But it's been, I've found it a very interesting and productive conversation. So thank you too.
Certainly been a pleasure meeting you, Simon, and to have this conversation. So thank you very much. It was good to hear Simon talking so much about Bowlby. One doesn't hear so much these days about those people who are working back in the 50s and 60s, but it also brings to mind, to me, those awful conflicts and the conflicts between therapists and psychoanalysts at that time. And one can't help wondering that although it all went into the great pool that was thinking about relational working and object relations work, I can't help wondering whether the kind of conflict somehow inhibited the spread of those ideas.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea, isn't it? Because I know when I was training that, you know, John Bowlby even then seemed, so we're talking about kind of like 25 years ago, and John Bowlby's ideas then seemed to be being presented as innovative, even though it was quite a long time after he'd been theorising. But yeah, I think really interesting to hear this perspective from somebody from a very different segment of society than people typically are when they find themselves in prison. But you could see so much of the same kinds of same kind of dynamics that people had been exposed to, whether they be in care or secure children's homes, as people being sent to boarding school, even though they're coming from this background of relative privilege, which is just heartbreaking, isn't it, when you think about so many children being subjected to that. And like I say, still seeing adverts for boarding schools that take children below secondary school age.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage lockeduplives.com and our Twitter account Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.